This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of ankylosing spondylitis from the spine section on orthobullets.com. Ankylosing spondylitis is a systemic, chronic autoimmune spondyloarthropathy characterized by a positive HLA-B27 histocompatibility complex 90% of the time and a negative rheumatoid factor, which can also be referred to as a seronegative spondyloarthropathy. Ankylosing spondylitis primarily affects the axial spine. As far as the pathoanatomy of ankylosing spondylitis, the exact mechanism is unknown, but it's most likely due to an autoimmune reaction to an environmental pathogen in a genetically susceptible individual. Theories of relation to HLA-B27 include that HLA-B27 aggregates with peptides in the joint and leads to a degenerative cascade. Another is that there is a cytotoxic T-cell autoimmune reaction against HLA-B27. Enthesitis is part of the pathoanatomy of ankylosing spondylitis. Enthesis is defined as the insertion of tendon, ligaments, or muscle into bone. Enthesis inflammation leads to bony erosion, surrounding soft tissue ossification, and eventually joint ankylosis. Ankylosing spondylitis preferentially targets sacroiliac joints, spinal apophyseal joints, and the symphysis pubis. This differentiates from rheumatoid arthritis, which is a synovial process. As far as disc space involvement, inflammation of the annulus leads to bridging osteophyte formation, otherwise known as syndesmophytes. As far as genetics, there is a genetic predisposition for ankylosing spondylitis, but the mode of inheritance is unknown. HLA-B27 is located on the B locus of the 6th chromosome. As far as epidemiology, ankylosing spondylitis has a 4-to-1 male-to-female ratio. It affects approximately 0.2% of the Caucasian population and usually presents in the third decade of life. The juvenile form in patients less than 16 years old includes enthesitis, and fewer than 10% of HLA-B27 positive patients have symptoms of ankylosing spondylitis. Diagnostic criteria for ankylosing spondylitis includes bilateral sacroiliitis, plus or minus uveitis, and HLA-B27 positive status. Systemic manifestations of ankylosing spondylitis include acute anterior uveitis and iritis, heart disease, specifically cardiac conduction abnormalities, pulmonary fibrosis, renal amyloidosis, ascending aortic conditions like aortitis, stenosis, and/or regurgitation, and Klebsiella pneumoniae synovitis, which HLA-B27 positive individuals are more susceptible to. Orthopedic manifestations of ankylosing spondylitis include bilateral sacroiliitis, progressive spinal kyphotic deformity, cervical spine fractures, and large joint arthritis, like hip and shoulder arthritis. As far as presentation of ankylosing spondylitis, symptoms include lumbosacral pain and stiffness, which is present in most patients and tends to be worse in the morning. It has an insidious onset in the third decade of life. Neck and upper thoracic pain occurs later in life. Acute neck pain should raise suspicion for fracture. Sciatic pain likely originates from the sciatic nerve involvement in the pelvic region, also known as a piriformis spasm. Ankylosing spondylitis patients may also present with loss of horizontal gaze and shortness of breath caused by costovertebral joint involvement, leading to reduced chest expansion. Physical exam may show limitation of chest wall expansion, and less than 2 centimeters of expansion is more specific than HLA-B27 for making the diagnosis of ankylosing spondylitis. Physical exam may also see decreased spine motion. The Schober test is used to evaluate lumbar stiffness. Physical exam may also reveal a kyphotic spine deformity. A chin-on-chest or flexion deformity of the spine is caused by multiple microfractures that occur over time. The chin-brow to vertical angle, or the CBVA, is measured from the standing lateral radiograph, and it's useful for preoperative planning. Correction of this angle correlates with improved surgical outcomes. Hip flexion contracture may also be seen on exam, and examining the patient in supine and the sitting position helps differentiate sagittal plane imbalance due to hip flexion contractures or kyphotic spinal deformity. Sacroiliac provocative tests for ankylosing spondylitis patients include the Faber test, in which flexion, abduction, and external rotation of the ipsilateral hip causes pain. With respect to imaging, radiographs of the spine as well as the pelvis and lower extremity in ankylosing spondylitis patients are recommended. Recommended views for the spine include a standing full-length AP and lateral of the axial spine. Findings are negative in 50% of cases with spine fractures. However, in those patients where there are findings, you may find squaring of the vertebrae with vertical or marginal syndesmophytes, as well as late vertebral scalloping, otherwise known as bamboo spine. Measurements include the chin-brow to vertical angle, as we previously mentioned, which again is used to measure the chin-on-chest deformity and is useful for preoperative planning for osteotomy. Recommended views for the pelvis and lower extremity include the Ferguson pelvic tilt view, which allows for improved visualization of the anterior SI joint. The view is taken with the x-ray directed 10 to 15 degrees cephalad, and findings may include bilateral symmetric sacroiliac erosion, and the earliest radiographic sign is erosion of the iliac side of the sacroiliac joint. You may also see joint space narrowing and ankylosis on this view. CT scan will show bony changes but not active inflammation. CT is the most sensitive test to diagnose cervical fractures in patients with ankylosing spondylitis. MRI will detect inflammation, making it the best modality for early detection of ankylosing spondylitis in young patients. An MRI should always be obtained with cervical fractures in ankylosing spondylitis patients to look for an epidural hemorrhage. A bone scan will show inflammation in the sacroiliac joints, but this test lacks specificity. As far as other studies like labs, they are of little diagnostic value, and you will often see nonspecific elevations in ESR and CRP. Diagnostic injections like an SI joint injection, where a local anesthetic is injected into the SI joint under fluoroscopic guidance, is often the most sensitive diagnostic test. One of the major diagnoses on the differential for ankylosing spondylitis that is often tested is diffuse idiopathic skeletal hyperostosis, or DISH. So let's quickly go over some of the major differences between DISH and ankylosing spondylitis. With respect to syndesmophytes, DISH has non-marginal syndesmophytes, while ankylosing spondylitis has marginal syndesmophytes. With respect to the radiographs, DISH has a characteristic, quote, flowing candle wax appearance, while ankylosing spondylitis has a, quote, bamboo spine, squaring of the vertebral bodies, and, quote, shiny corners at the attachment of the annulus fibrosus, aka a Romanus lesion. With respect to the disc space, DISH has preservation of the disc space, while the cervical spine in ankylosing spondylitis will show ossification of the disc space. With respect to osteopenia, DISH has no osteopenia. Rather, there may be an increased radiodensity, while ankylosing spondylitis does have osteopenia present. With respect to HLA, DISH has no evidence of association with HLA-B27. However, it is associated with HLA-B8, which is common in patients with DISH and diabetes, while ankylosing spondylitis has a strong association with HLA-B27. With respect to age group, DISH tends to be found in older patients, that is middle age, compared with ankylosing spondylitis, which can be found in relatively younger patients. As far as SI joint involvement, DISH has no SI joint involvement, and in fact, SI joint abnormality generally excludes a diagnosis of DISH, while ankylosing spondylitis is characterized by bilateral sacroiliitis. As far as diabetes, DISH is associated with diabetes, while ankylosing spondylitis is not. Moving on to treatment of ankylosing spondylitis, non-operative management involves NSAIDs, COX-2 inhibitors, and physical therapy, which is indicated as the first line of treatment for pain and stiffness. And remember that oral steroids are not recommended in these patients. Physical therapy should focus on maintaining flexibility. TNF-alpha blocking agents are the second line of medical management, and these include drugs like infliximab, etanercept, and adalimumab. As far as outcomes of using TNF-alpha blocking agents for ankylosing spondylitis, clinical studies show significant improvement in the severity of symptoms. We'll talk about operative options shortly when we talk about spinal trauma, spinal deformity, and large joint arthritis. As far as spine trauma in ankylosing spondylitis, this mostly occurs in the mid-cervical and the cervical-thoracic junction, while some occur at the thoracolumbar junction. With respect to the pathoanatomy of spine trauma in ankylosing spondylitis, this often manifests as extension-type fractures that involve all three columns. As far as the prognosis, there is a high mortality rate secondary to epidural hemorrhage, and 75% of patients have neurologic involvement. With respect to presentation, symptoms usually present with pain after a low-energy fall. On physical exam, neurologic deficits often present late and therefore patients should be admitted and observed. Imaging should include radiographs which may show occult fractures. CT scans should be obtained if you are suspicious for spine trauma in ankylosing spondylitis patients, and it is actually the best modality to make the diagnosis. MRI should be obtained in ankylosing spondylitis patients with spine trauma, as there is a high mortality rate secondary to epidural hemorrhage. With respect to treatment of spine trauma in ankylosing spondylitis patients, non-operative management involves immobilizing patients in the existing kyphotic position, low weight traction may facilitate reduction, and these patients should be admitted for observation and advanced imaging. Indications for non-operative management include stable spine fractures with no neurologic deficits. Operative management involves spinal decompression with instrumented fusion. Indications for this includes progressive neurologic deficit, epidural hematoma with neurologic compromise, and/or unstable fracture patterns. The decision to go anterior or posterior depends on fracture level, presence and location of hematoma, and osteoporosis. Instrumentation is needed to obtain a long fusion construct. Multiple points of fixation above and below the fracture are necessary because of osteoporosis and the long lever arms of the ankylosed spine. It's important that you do not make an effort to correct the deformity. As far as outcomes and complications, there is a high rate of complications including progressive deformity, non-union, hardware failure, and/or infection. With respect to spinal deformity in ankylosing spondylitis, it's usually a kyphotic deformity of the upper spine, but be sure to eliminate hip contractures as the reason for the deformity. Treatment can include lumbar osteotomy or a C7 to T1 cervical thoracic osteotomy, depending on where the deformity is. Lumbar osteotomy is indicated for a thoracolumbar kyphotic deformity. The goal is to restore sagittal balance and horizontal gaze. Techniques for a lumbar osteotomy include a closing wedge, aka a pedicle subtracting osteotomy, vertebral body resection, single-level opening wedge osteotomy, and a multi-segment opening osteotomy. A closing wedge or pedicle subtracting osteotomy involves a transpedicular decancellation procedure with removal of the posterior elements, and the location of the osteotomy is determined by the type of spine flexion deformity. The hinge is located on the anterior vertebral body. A pedicle subtracting osteotomy is considered the procedure of choice due to greater deformity correction, because you'll get 30 to 40 degrees per level, as well as better fusion and stability due to direct bony apposition. In a vertebral body resection, the entire vertebral body is removed and replaced with a cage. A single-level opening wedge osteotomy hinges on the posterior edge of the vertebral body, and this option requires rupture of the anterior longitudinal ligament. Finally, a multi-segment opening osteotomy has the advantage of less bone loss and preservation of the anterior longitudinal ligament by distributing correction over multiple levels. As far as outcomes and complications, the lumbar approach avoids complications of a thoracic cage, spinal cord injury, and has potential for greater correction due to the long lever arm of ankylosing spondylitis. Moving on to C7 to T1 cervical thoracic osteotomies, indications include a cervical thoracic kyphotic or chin-on-chest deformity, and the goals include slight undercorrection with a final brow-to-chin angle of 10 degrees. The advantage of a C7 to T1 osteotomy includes that the vertebral artery is external to the transverse foramen, and there is a larger canal diameter at this level. A C7 to T1 osteotomy requires wide decompression with removal of the C7 lateral mass and portions of C7 to T1 pedicles to prevent iatrogenic spinal cord injury. As far as instrumentation, there will usually be a combination of lateral mass screws, pedicle screws, and sublaminar hooks. Postoperative halo immobilization is often required in patients with poor bone quality. As far as outcomes and complications, there is an increased risk of venous air embolus in the sitting operative position. Finally, moving on to large joint arthritis in ankylosing spondylitis patients, there tends to be an asymmetric involvement of large joints. The shoulder and the hip are most commonly involved. Treatment for hip arthritis includes a total hip replacement, which is indicated in patients with severe arthritis of the hips secondary to ankylosing spondylitis. These patients tend to have a more vertical and antiverted acetabulum, and this may lead to anterior dislocations after total hip arthroplasty. A bilateral total hip arthroplasty is indicated for a kyphotic deformity due to hip flexion contracture deformities. As far as outcomes and complications, these patients may be at an increased risk for dislocation. That's all for this review about ankylosing spondylitis. Hopefully that was helpful. Look out for questions related to this topic on this weekend's question session, and hopefully this episode will have prepared you for that review. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.